Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The issue in the Middle East is so polarized that the stance that South Africa has taken, the government of Israel may believe that they are closer to the Palestinian cause. At the same time, the U.S. is no longer seen as an honest broker.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says South Africa is ready to mediate the conflict between Israel and Hamas.
So look at what we've just been through. There's this tangled knot of crises. We had climate change. Then along came COVID, and that undermined people's livelihood. Then along came the Russia-Ukraine war.
The Commonwealth of Nations Secretariat calls for new global financial architecture that addresses the effect of climate change.
Well, the chairperson congratulated Liberians for the peaceful manner in which they conducted themselves in casting their ballots. So I think it was good. And she hopes that they will continue that way until the final results are announced.
And the National Electoral Commission calls on Liberian citizens to remain calm as it releases the results of the general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. With Israel ordering the evacuation of some 1 million Palestinian civilians from Gaza City within 24 hours, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has expanded his crisis talks from Israel and Jordan to include all the Gulf Arab countries and Egypt. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Sidney Sain reports.
Residents of Gaza City packed their belongings and squeezed into cars or fled on foot Friday after Israel called for all civilians in Gaza City, roughly 1 million people, to leave the city and head to southern Gaza within 24 hours. One resident said Israel threw down leaflets saying everyone had to leave or be annihilated, and he asked why women and children had to be terrorized. Addressing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is a priority, U.S. President Joe Biden said during a speech on the economy in Philadelphia. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Friday that conditions in Gaza have reached a new low.
Possible.
In Israel Friday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin demonstrated American solidarity with Israel after last week's brutal attacks by Hamas militants that prompted Israel to declare war on Hamas. Some 3,100 people have died this week in Israel and Gaza. Austin told reporters,
"Terrorists like Hamas deliberately target civilians. But democracies don't. This is a time for resolve and not revenge, for purpose and not panic, and for security and not surrender."
After his visit to Israel Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Jordan's King Abdullah and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Amman on Friday, before traveling on to Qatar. He was asked if he was worried that Israel was retaliating against Hamas in an emotional response it might later regret.
What Israel is doing is not retaliation. What Israel is doing is defending the lives of its people and, as I said, trying to make sure that this cannot happen again.
Blinken said the U.S. is focused on working with international organizations and partners in the region to establish what he called safe zones for Palestinian civilians. What these safe zones could look like is likely to be a topic of discussion on Saturday and Sunday, as Blinken hold talks in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa says his country is prepared to mediate the conflict between Israel and Hamas. This after the president called for a ceasefire. He added that South Africa has experience in conflict resolution that can help resolve the war. The president also expressed concern about what he calls atrocities against civilians, but some skeptics wonder if the government in Pretoria will be an honest broker due to its close relations with the Palestinians. For more reaction about the conflict in South Africa's call for ceasefire, I reach Professor Somadoda Fikeni. He is a political analyst and the chairperson of South Africa's Public Service Commission.
It's actually a tragedy in the process, and even more tragic events are coming our way. And it is going to impact not only the Palestinians under occupation.
The issue in the Middle East is so polarized that the stance that South Africa has taken, the government of Israel may believe that they are closer to the Palestinian cause. At the same time, the U.S. is no longer seen as an honest broker because it is supporting Israel and arming Israel. So I do think that South Africa can add to many voices which say this cannot be resolved militarily, but it can be resolved through a political solution, just like the Oslo Accord had attempted to do that. And it doesn't matter what the military outcome right now is, but the ramifications across the region are such that South Africa will add to many voices that are calling for a negotiations drawn from its own experience of conflict that was resolved through negotiations. But I doubt South Africa alone would be able to do that. You need a cumulative effect of many countries which talk about the two sides negotiating. And it should not even focus on the Hamas, but rather deal with the broader Palestinian issue, in which even the Fatah, which is the ruling party in the West Bank, could also be a factor, rather than the Hamas versus the current Israeli government, because those could be the extremes. And here you need the center and the moderates to carry forward any peace process.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps South Africa should have channeled its willingness to mediate through the African Union with its more than 50 members. That would give it a little bit more weight. That would be more of a neutral stance that Israel could accommodate, because there are suggestions that South Africa seem to be more closer to the Palestinian cause rather than what Israel is looking for. What are your thoughts?
Actually, this is a lot more complex than that. The AU has countries which are closer to Israel with very close military and economic ties, whereas you also have a similar situation with the UN Security Council. That's why no position can be taken clearly. So there is no unanimity on this, where you would say a continental body would take a position. And besides, the continent would hardly take a position on a conflict that they think it's Middle Eastern and Arab, unlike in Ukraine, because there the grain supply and the food insecurity was very specific. In the case of Israel and Palestine, there is no immediate African interest in that for the continent to take a position.
So, Dr. Fikeni, what do you think the strategic benefit is for South Africa to offer itself? In this case, President Ramaphosa's statement saying South Africa is ready to be the mediator in the ongoing conflict.
Well, I do think that South Africa is trying to emphasize its own experience and history to say how conflicts have been resolved between erstwhile enemies. But it is also trying to show consistency on what it had been saying in the case of the war in Ukraine, between Russia and Ukraine, to say negotiate. So that is just to posture and present consistency rather than realistically thinking that you will be able to resolve, especially at this sensitive time, the issue of Middle East.
Dr. Fikeni, from the African perspective, and more so from the South African perspective, what do you think the way forward is to resolve this problem once and for all in the Middle East, since Egypt, as a member of the African Union, it's a close neighbor to Israel?
I do think that South Africa would do well having bilaterals with countries which are directly involved, like the US, Egypt, UAE, and several other countries, and say we can support any collective process. The complexity of Middle East is such that no single country, not even the US at this stage, can ever be able to resolve those problems. It needs a collective, concerted effort.
Somadoda Fikeni is a political analyst and the chairperson of South Africa's Public Service Commission. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. A scholar and former Egyptian Assistant Foreign Minister for Arab Affairs says the international community should draw inspiration from the agreement between Egypt and Israel to help resolve the Israeli-Hamas conflict. Ambassador Abdel Rahman Salah al-Din, who is also former permanent representative of Egypt to the Arab League and currently a member of the Board of Egyptian Council on Foreign Affairs, says the deal ensured peace between the two governments, which has endured for decades. He adds that a shift in focus by Western nations, such as the one that led to an end of apartheid in South Africa, could significantly help broker a lasting solution to the conflict between Israel and Hamas. I reach Ambassador Abdel Rahman Salah al-Din via Skype about his take on the latest development in the conflict and how best to resolve it.
It's actually a tragedy in the process, and even more tragic events are coming our way. And it is going to impact not only the Palestinians under occupation in Gaza, but and Israelis who are living nearby, but also other countries in the region, and maybe other international powers who might be dragged in this conflict. If we don't stop it, and if we don't make a quick diplomatic move to prevent more bloodshed.
Egypt seemed to always try to play a neutral role. But in this case, what do you think Egypt can do to try to help resolve this impasse or this ongoing conflict?
Well, Egypt actually provides a very good example of how this conflict should be resolved, the Arab-Israeli conflict, because Egypt decided that the October war should be the last war between Arabs and Israelis. That was the case for Egypt and Israel, because we concluded our peace in 1979. And only through this peace, Israel felt secured vis-a-vis Egypt, and Egypt felt secured vis-a-vis Israel. So only through peace and only through the Egyptian-Israeli model, Israel can secure its people's safety, prosperity, and existence. No weapon is going to guarantee that, and no military superiority is going to guarantee that. And the recent events is a good proof to that. Regardless of who is committing the attacks, today it is Hamas, tomorrow it could be anyone else. So even eliminating Hamas and it is fighters' forces, is not going to solve it. And it's going to come at a very high cost. This is why I warn against a big military operation that would cost thousands of lives, of innocent lives, on both sides in this case, actually. So and the potential to drag in other countries in the region and other countries of outside the region, including the United States, by the way.
So, Ambassador, why do you think the international community, including the Arab League, neighboring countries, the Western nations, even including the African Union, have been unable to resolve this problem once and for all? Because conflict happened, there's a truce, then they go back to fighting again, thousands of lives lost from both sides. Why do you think this keep festering with no end in sight?
I think we can think of apartheid, the problem of apartheid, as the good answer to your question. Apartheid lasted for dozens of years beyond the Human Rights Declaration, Universal Human Rights Declaration, only because the international community, especially the Western nation, especially the United States, did not support ending apartheid. Only when the West changed position and decided to end apartheid, the problem of apartheid ended and resolved. The same with the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. You know, Arabs and Israelis, like all nations who are in conflict, have decided that 1967 is the threshold, the historic compromise borders, the lines of 1967. We all agreed on that. We all accepted United Nations resolutions to that effect. We even concluded peace on that basis, like the Egyptian and the Jordanian peace.
Ambassador Abdelrahman Salah Heldin is a distinguished scholar and former Egyptian Assistant Foreign Minister for Arab Affairs. He spoke with me via Skype from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. In Morocco, the Commonwealth of Nations Secretariat is calling for a new global financial architecture to address the effect of climate change and for alleviating debt to help build resilient economies. The call came during the Commonwealth Finance Ministers' meeting on the sidelines of the annual International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings over the past few days in Marrakech, Morocco. The finance ministers discussed new sources of finance and access to climate change funds, as well as financing for a green transition. For more about the Commonwealth's positions, I reached the Commonwealth Secretary General Patricia Scotland via Skype. Topics she highlighted in the conversation include debt distress, especially for the Commonwealth's developing members, and managing debt to build resilient economies. She also talked about enhancing access to recently developed climate funds and the organization's Climate Finance Access Hub.
So look at what we've just been through. There's this tangled knot of crises. We had climate change. Then along came COVID, and that undermined people's livelihood. Then along came the Russia-Ukraine war. And now we have even more instability as a result of what's just happened in the Middle East. These are all exogenous shocks which have derailed many of our countries. Now in that situation, we have to ask the question, does our current financial infrastructure internationally fit the needs of the countries t- today? And the answer is, if a system is predicated on GPD only, it does not.
Mm. Madam Secretary General, talk to me about the debt distress, especially to members of the Commonwealth who are managing debt at the moment to build, you know, what some people will term resilient economies.
Well, many of our countries, because of the reasons we've just explained, are heavily in debt now, because there's a direct correlation between the level of debt and the level of climate and other distress to which they have been subject. And their ability to respond has been limited because if you look at, for instance, the LDCs, the least developed countries, they borrow half the amount, perhaps, of the other more developed countries, yet they pay back three times the amount in interest rates. So if you're thinking about it, if I have to pay three times the amount for the same amount of money, then I am never going to be able to get onto the same platform. And if you look at why the credit rating for some of our countries is lower than others, it's because we have been subject to climatic and other stresses, which were not caused or contributed by us, was caused or contributed by others, and yet we are having to respond. So what we're arguing for is that there should be equity, not just climate equity, but equity when it comes to loans, equity when it comes to interest, and these issues have to be addressed with greater vigor.
So, Madam Commonwealth Secretary General, before you go, talk to me about how member countries of the Commonwealth are reacting to the Commonwealth Climate Finance Access Hub that you described about.
Well, they're thrilled that we are able to do this. And we're just talking about it today. And they were commending everything the Secretariat is doing. But, you know, we've been able to do that only because we have worked hand in glove with our member states. It's their ingenuity, it's their commitment, it's their hard work. And it's the fact that they're willing to trust us with the information, share their knowledge, their expertise, enabling us to help them. But what I find is truly beautiful about our Commonwealth is if you ask any of your members, when they've invested so much time and effort to develop something for themselves, my brother, my sister, will you share this with me so I can share it with others? Every single one of them says, of course, Secretary General. And that is the power of our family, that if one of us is in trouble, the others are willing to stand shoulder to shoulder and say, I may not have much, but what I have is yours. And that's very, very special. And I know that a lot of the richer countries are under a lot of pressure and it is hard for them, but I'm still asking all of them to say, please don't turn your back on your more vulnerable brothers and sisters. Please continue to do what you've always done in the Commonwealth family. Stand with us in solidarity, help us. And also, this is a moment for business, because I'm constantly hearing business saying, what can we do to help? We're willing to help. And you know, we've got our agenda, our connectivity agenda, looking at blue and green economy. So I would say to anybody listening, look on our website, see what we're doing with our blue charter, with our living lands charter, with our common sensing, which is using geospatial data. Look at what we're doing in relation to try and create a green carbon tax, the debt and nature swaps, all these innovative, and come and help us. Come and share your expertise and maybe even share your resources to help us to help our members to save the world in which we're all living, because our time is running out and the moment to help is now.
Patricia Scotland is the Commonwealth Secretary General. She spoke with me via Skype from Marrakesh, Morocco. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Liberia, the National Electoral Commission is calling on citizens to remain calm as it releases the results of the recent general election. This after some candidates claimed they won last Tuesday's vote. The electoral law, officials of the commission reminded the candidate, allows it 15 days to announce the winner of any election. Both local and international poll observers, including ECOWAS and the African Union election monitoring groups, have hailed the people of Liberia for the peaceful vote. For more about the just concluded polls and the release of results, I reach Henry Flomo. He is the spokesperson for Liberia's National Electoral Commission.
Well, the chairperson congratulated Liberians for the peaceful manner in which they conducted themselves in casting their ballots. So I think it was good. And she hopes that they will continue that way until the final results are announced.
Henry, some people have expressed concern that although Liberians have remained calm, waiting for the Electoral Commission to announce the result, some of the candidates, especially the presidential candidate, are declaring themselves winner based on what they say are results they are getting from their respective representatives across the country, showing them their victory. What is the position of the Electoral Commission in this regard?
Again, the commission, through the chairperson, has continued to advise stakeholders, party officials, not to declare themselves. That authority is only given to the National Elections Commission. So she has continued to warn, and I'm sure today again she's going to do that so that we all remain peaceful until the elections, I mean, the results are announced as already started yesterday.
How long should the people of Liberia wait to see who they chose as their representatives from the local level all the way to the presidential level?
The law gives maximum of 15 days to the commission. So within 15 days, the commission should be able to announce. And that started yesterday. And thank the chairperson and the rest of the poll members started releasing results today. And they're going to continue today, tomorrow, until the results are all exhausted.
What has been the commission's reaction following the initial response from the African Union Poll Observer Mission, as well as the ECOWAS Poll Observer Mission that monitored the poll?
The chairperson, Madam Deirdre Brown-Lassana, has always welcomed the observers, local and international. In fact, she held meetings with almost all of them prior to the casting of ballot. And I think it's good that her work is being monitored by everyone across the world, and that because that will indeed validate the good works. So the commission is happy.
So what is the commission's message to the people of Liberia as the Electoral Commission releases the results from all the polling stations across the country?
The commission is, again, like I said, the chairperson has always expressed delight over the manner in which Liberians have conducted themselves. So as the results come from all 5,890 polling stations, she, along with the rest of the board members, will continue the announcement. Tally is ongoing across the country. So as the results are being tallied electronically, they are being filed to the commission, and the board will continue to announce. That includes today. And I hope that everyone can follow. And of course, the results are also on our website. And I will send you the link if you don't mind.
Henry Flomo is the spokesperson for Liberia's National Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Monrovia. In Uganda, an opposition member of parliament has sharply denied insulting a colleague lawmaker from the governing National Resistance Army, or NRM. Francis Zack, a leading member of the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, says his lawyers will soon challenge accusations that he verbally abused Juliet Kanyamata. This after Kanyamata demanded action from parliament, which led to a 10-minute suspension due to the allegation. Local news media reports the issue has been reported to the Privileges Committee for further investigation and possible punitive action against Zack. But Francis Zack tells me that the accusation is a diversionary tactic from the ruling party to prevent parliament from debating more substantial issues.
We have very important matters to discuss in parliament, especially matters concerned about the attack on the party headquarters and the attack on our party president, Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, who was abducted on the tarmac of the airport without even passing through the immigration. So we brought up those issues as the opposition in parliament, and we wanted a response. Instead of government giving us a response, they have come up with a diverting matter of that honorable member of parliament from Rakai, Honorable Harriet Kinyamatama, to come up with that statement of accusing me of, you know, of abusing her, of saying defamatory statements about her, that she's alleging stuff that is not true at all. So to me, I'm just handling those matters with my lawyers. But the most important issue that we want to demand from parliament is to concentrate on the issues that are affecting Ugandans, the issues of abductions, opposition members illegally, the matters of attacking political parties in parliament, the matters that are really, really oppressing our people in this country.
If she is offended by your remarks that she is only marketing herself in parliament and not addressing the issues, why wouldn't you just apologize to her? She is your fellow member of parliament. Apologize to her and move on with the substantive issues that you said you were more focused on.
First and foremost, my brother Peter, you have to understand that I'm a member of parliament on the ticket of NUP, and she's a member of parliament on the ticket of NRM. And the NRM party she belongs to, that is the party that is responsible of oppressing our people. So I cannot befriend and say sorry to someone who is responsible of abducting our people, of violating the human rights of our people. I cannot do that, yet I spoke the truth that instead of those people concentrating on useful issues Ugandans are concerned about, they are addressing petty issues. And the matter I really addressed, it is telling the truth. That is the truth of the matter. So since they are taking me in the disciplinary committee, I'll get there. I'm going to consult my lawyers and then also try to also look into that video they are talking about. And then I challenge them.
So don't you think that there should be an easy way to resolve this? Because now you are being referred to the disciplinary committee for an investigation and possible recommendation of punishment.
First and foremost, I was not given an opportunity to defend myself. That is one. Because Parliament is supposed to come up and say, you know, yes, the Honorable Member said ABC about you, Honorable Zake. What do you have to say about this matter? They didn't give me that chance, that opportunity. And that has always been happening. It's not the first time they are sending me in that committee. But they always never give me an opportunity to tell them my side. They never give me a fair hearing. How do they expect me to do that? That is the parliament that is responsible for my torture. First and foremost, you well know that in that parliament, I was tortured in that parliament. And I have the video, my brother. So how do you expect such a parliament to hear my side? That is one. The second point, I've always been tortured outside parliament. That parliament has never been concerned about my issues. But they are concerned about issues that are just personal on someone, you know? You can imagine such a situation. We are supposed to concentrate on issues that really concern Ugandans, not petty issues. That's not supposed to be the way, my brother.
What do you say to those who are saying that you are a rabble-rouser in parliament, you try to cause confusion, delay parliamentary duties, and you've been found guilty in breach of public trust and parliamentary decorum?
And they would ask you that if you want the substantive issues to be addressed in parliament, then you should respect the house to represent your people without what they say, publicity stunt to draw attention to yourself.
My brother, first and foremost, what you have to understand, that in that parliament, we are supposed to be respecting Ugandan issues. How come parliament has never been suspended on issues that are really concerning our people? First and foremost, I've never been found guilty. I've always been going to that committee. I've always been winning whatever matter they put in that committee. And I'm so sure even this very matter, I will always win them. Because first and foremost, they always don't have evidence against me. How do you expect me to say sorry on something that I did not do? We are supposed to, they are diverting us from issues that we are supposed to be addressing that parliament. Not those other petty issues, really.
Francis Zaake is a parliamentarian and leading member of the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Zambia, an opposition member of parliament is calling on President Hakainde Hichilema to rescind the appointment of the new Auditor General Ron Mwambwa. This after legislator Mutotwe Kafuwaya says the appointment contravenes the constitution. The constitution, he argues, states that the Auditor General must be below 60 years of age, but the newly appointed Auditor General is 64 years old based on official public records. Kafuwaya argues this disqualifies Mwambwa, but supporters of the government dismissed the lawmaker's argument, saying the president has constitutional latitude to appoint the best person to do the job. For more reaction following the appointment of the Auditor General, I reach parliamentarian Mutotwe Kafuwaya in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
The appointment of the Auditor General is actually unconstitutional. Article 252 of the Constitution of our Republic says, and I quote, subject to this article, the Auditor General shall retire from office on attaining the age of 60 years, end of quote. Now, the man who has been appointed Auditor General, subject to ratification by the National Assembly of Zambia, is actually 64 years old. So you cannot appoint somebody who is 64 years old to an office, a constitutional office, for which retirement age is 60 years.
The Constitution also gives the president a lot of latitude to decide or appoint who he feels will best serve the interests of his government and, for that matter, the people of Zambia. And if he decides to choose whoever to work with, why is the patriotic front going against it, saying it's illegal, when the Constitution gives the president the latitude to appoint whoever, or he can even call people from retirement to come and work?
Absolutely. And I can tell you that retirement age in many cases would be 55 years, 45 years, 65 years, and 60 years. For the Auditor General, this is a constitutional office. A constitutional office is one which is determined by the constitutional provision or provisions. In this case, our constitution, the supreme law of the land, says when you attain the age of 60 and you are Auditor General, you retire. That's what the Constitution says. So according to our Constitution, we cannot have an Auditor General who is above 60 years old. Dr. Ron Mwambwa is 64 years old. He is unconstitutional, or should I say, he is illegal in the office. But of course, the president has got latitude to appoint whoever he wants. They must be below 60 years old. There's no other way. He can choose anyone, including myself. I must be below 60 years for me to become Auditor General.
What do you say to those who are saying that the PF is just playing politics with this, and that
you have raised such issue in parliament, you were reprimanded in parliament, and you are still making accusations or allegations that the president's choice is illegal because it does not meet the constitutional threshold. How do you respond to that?
Listen, there are a myriad of issues which are in there, okay? First of all, it is okay for somebody to think we are politicking around this issue because that's how they say. Personally, I am not politicking on this issue, and I cannot politic because this is a constitutional matter. And I swore to protect the Constitution. Let me just read for you something on Article 2 of our Constitution so that you know where I am coming from. So Article 2 says, and I quote, every person has the right and duty to A, defend this Constitution, and B, resist or prevent a person from overthrowing, suspending, or illegally abrogating this Constitution. So I have a duty to prevent the abrogation of this Constitution, and this is exactly what I am doing. Now, the matter has been raised in Parliament. Yes, Parliament is yet to bring about the process of ratification. Once that comes up, we shall be able to have our say. But that doesn't mean the appointment has not been done. The president has already appointed him. He's just waiting for ratification. So I can talk about this appointment as being illegal because it is not supported by the Constitution. When it comes for ratification, there will be other conversations around ratifications, and all of us are going to bring our diversity on the issue. But the fact that he has been appointed is the wrong appointment, and the president must consider reversing the appointment.
Mutotwe Kafuaya is a member of the Zambian Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Cameroon, a think tank is calling for solutions to the challenges facing the Central African region. The call was made during the maiden edition of a two-day summit of the Central African think tanks held in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Organized by the Nkafu Policy Institute, the meetings were held under the theme Optimizing the Impact of Think Tanks in the Central African Region. The summit, which brought together over 25 research groups across the region, aimed to find solutions to such challenges as political instability, insecurity, women's empowerment, and job creation for youth. For more about the outcomes of the summit and expectations, I reached Dr. Dennis Foritia. He is the founder and co-chair of the Nkafu Policy Institute.
The Central Africa Think Tank Forum was really the first time ever that we brought together think tanks or independent policy research institutions from the enlarged ECOWAS region. And part of the reason for doing this was really because the independent research institutions in this region, unfortunately, are not as structured and well-run as in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And so there was a real need for us to ensure that we could come together, federate our forces, and ensure that we aligned, especially because, as you know, our ecosystem in the Central Africa region is one that is not very free and open. And so we want to push towards a very open Central Africa region. The main takeaway is that independent research institutions really came together to create a Central Africa think tank network, a network that would allow them to work together on various thematic areas, whether it's looking at the economics of the region, jobs, unemployment situation, the situation of women, climate change, governance, and the different security challenges that the region faces. So that was really one of the major outcomes.
The Central African region is experiencing a lot of turbulence politically and security-wise. How will this think tank, in your estimation, try to address some of these challenges? Because Gabon is facing a similar problem where Ali Bongo Ondimba was overthrown. Central African Republic is having its own difficulties. And other countries in the neighborhood, including Cameroon, where, you know, there's this ongoing Anglophone crisis.
We know that there is a democracy deficit across the continent. And this is really been perpetrated by a deficit of governance. Many people and leaders have come into power And rather than serving and be of service to the countries, have not actually gone down the democratic pipeline. Part of it is due to the fact that they've had the countries closed, rule of law is not maintained, and we believe that fundamentally, even looking at other countries and regions, and an open ecosystem for ideas where policies are implemented using evidence is very important. So for the issues that you talk about regarding the crisis in Gabon and the Central Africa region as a whole, think tanks have a major role to play, because these are really issues of the citizens not being happy with the current state of affairs, and we cannot continue to run things the way we are running in our countries and expect a different outcome.
So moving forward, for those who live in the entire Central Africa region, what should be their expectation based on this latest think tank meeting you had in Cameroon? What should be their expectation regarding improving their daily lives and policy issues that could help improve their living conditions?
That was the reason why we actually had this first meeting, and we are in consultation, and through the network, we are going to have a second forum in August of next year, of 2024, to be able to build on, you know, the successes of this first forum. But what we are looking is that all the think tanks and independent research from member countries in the ECOWAS region, whether it's in Burundi, in Rwanda, in Chad, in Angola, in Sao Tome and Principe, in Gabon, those think tanks become stronger and have a greater impact on the policy ecosystem in their various countries. And also for us to ensure that there is more input into the economic communities in the Central Africa region regarding the policies that affect directly the little man in the street. So that is what this is all about. It's about how to ensure that they have the jobs that they need and all the opportunities that, you know, is God-given and that currently they are not enjoying.
Dr. Dennis Foretia is the founder and co-chair of the Nkafu Policy Institute. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. African fashion has gained much recognition in recent years due to its rich cultural heritage, vibrant colors, and unique designs. The industry is on the rise, and African designers are now showcasing their creativity on international runway shows. Jonda Morris is the founder of Runway Africa. She talks to my colleague David Vandy about the rise and recognition of the African fashion industry that has gained in recent years.
Well, you know, the vibrant colors in African fashion, some of the aesthetics that African designers bring to the table, it's just, it's so dynamic. And African fashion are usually trendsetters. We set the trends and others follow. People are imitating what African designers are doing. But those vibrant and bright colors are always, it's what attracts people to African fashion.
So what are the latest fashion designs that is trending across the continent right now?
Well, you know, mixing the African designs with European, you know, the European looks, but using the Ankara fabric. And now what you have is that a lot of countries in Africa have the traditional fabric. You know, from, you know, we see from Sierra Leone, the kabasla is coming back. Kabasla used to be one of the biggest things back in the day, and Sierra Leone was known for kabasla. Those designs are coming back, but they're more modern. You know, in some countries, you have the mud cloth. Those things are trending, and because it's heavy, people are using them now to do winter coats in the U.S. But every African country has their own fabric that they weave. So those people are starting to get to their culture. In Liberia, we have the country cloth. In Mali, you know, the mud cloths are there. In Ghana, you have the kente. In Nigeria, you have the ashoke. But every country are now starting to go to their roots, because fabrics, some of those fabrics are hand done and handmade by artisans all across Africa, and everybody has their own traditional roots, but they're trying to bring that to life.
How is Africa bridging the gap between African fashion designers in the continent and those in the West?
Well, you know, one of the things that has happened now, you know, a lot of Africans are in a diaspora, so African designers are coming and being part of big shows. You have producers that are African that are opening that has opened the gateway to be able to invite African designers from Africa, bringing them into the U.S., taking them into Europe. Now there are African designers that are going to Asia, and they're on the runway with other designers. So just being able to have more platforms that African designers can go to showcase. In London, you have Africa Fashion Week London. You know, Lagos have the Lagos Fashion Week, but they bring in designers from all across Africa. But these platforms now are opening, so these designers have a way to come outside, market their products, and, you know, they go back, and now they're able to make money and take that money back and be able to reproduce garments.
How far?
Jonda Morris is the founder of Runway Africa. She spoke with my colleague David Vandy from here in Washington. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
You get one life only. Mister, get one life only. Why we no go use? I'm gladdy, gladdy. And enjoy the time. Palava no dey finish. Time me no dey wait nobody. Now why are they try for always get them nice every day and night? This world way we all fend we safe. Not nobody own. You wanna eat with you much we go down. You belay now in you young. And the balance where you go die left. Now all the money on. So why for the pity you say for? Now the motor car where you let like, buy em. Buy em. If you see fine us where you where you let like Yanam, Yanam, and if you eat, you let like the manna for keep em. Want them more. The food where you feel for eat some, for eat them, eat them. That fine, fine, la fine where you let like, na for buy em. And try em more. And if you baby love you, you back love them, love them. But if you love them more, now you na for left em. Want them more. Cause nobody, nobody know. Nobody know what in tomorrow old. So every day of my life they are old. I pass in enjoyment they go. I fall and for care for yourself. Nobody love you pass to yourself. All man they fed for himself. Oh. Now why all the allowed with the other man they panting. Me peace away, away. Me joy away, away. Me smile away, away. Oh no no. No make nobody take you peace away, away. Me joy away, away. Me smile away.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer David Vandy and engineers Helen Kudian and Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how good you are to a goat, it will always eat your yam. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
If you see finals where you call it Bilam, Bilam, you meet a woman where you let Pianam, Yanam, and if you eat, you let the manna for keep on. Want them more. The food where you feel for eat some, for eat some, eat some. That fine, fine, that fine where you let na for buy them. And try them more. And if you baby love you, you back love them, love them. But if you love them more, now you na for left them. Want them more. Cause nobody, nobody know. Nobody know what in tomorrow all. So every day of my life they are old. I pass in enjoyment they go. Now for land for care for yourself. Nobody love you pass to yourself. All man they fed for yourself. Oh. Now why are not the allowed with the other man they part. Take me peace away. Away. Me joy away. Away. Me smile away.